Dealing with Loneliness. The fourth talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Nancy Scott on January 28, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I was asked to lead the discussion tonight on dealing with loneliness, and I thought about what where this topic fits in the progression of the course that we're doing and kind of where what we've been talking about, and it seems to me that it fits well as a continuation of our discussion from emotional fornication to dating. We've kind of run around the topic a bit of what do we do with our needs and what do we do with our feelings and what do we do with this loneliness inside of us that is a big part of what propels us to connect with other people. And since we've been talking about ways of connecting with other people that may or may not be appropriate, then it seems to fit that way. So what I thought I would do tonight actually is just reflect a little bit on some observations that I've made over time and just kind of talk a little bit about what I think about loneliness. And I asked Wes and Tamara to join me, and we'll do like we've done in the past couple of weeks, where I'll probably talk for 20 or 30 minutes, and then they'll join me and make comments, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So it seems to me that there are various ways we respond to loneliness in ourselves and in our culture. One of the big ways is to not be alone. Hooking up with a partner, hooking up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, which is part of a big part of what we've talked about for the last couple of weeks, and what that looks like. What we're trying to say is that marriage is really the context for romantic relationships to happen, and given that outside of marriage, romantic relationships are not appropriate, we're questioning that practice, that what we do with our loneliness is we hook up with somebody. So there's a lot of other ways we can respond. Kind of get busy, ignore it, become a hermit, be isolated, turn inward. There's also answers given these days in a New Age Eastern kind of context that have to do with kind of a mystical connection with the one, that we leave our individuality behind and that our individuality is actually an illusion, but that we're really part of something bigger and that we can mystically experience that and not have to be alone somehow there. I think that there's also forms of Christian mysticism that have similar answers, even though they have different details. It seems to me that there's a lot of Christian mysticism out there that suggests that the way we deal with our loneliness is to develop a personal relationship with God and experience Him as father, brother, husband, kind of fit Him into an image or an ideal of what we want to have reflected in our own lives and kind of create Him into that and experience that emotionally in some way so that we don't have to be alone. Now, that's not to say there aren't real emotions connected with understanding and knowing who God is. But I'm talking about something different, that we kind of create an image of a father or a brother or a husband with God that serves more to take us away from this experience we have of loneliness rather than that it's really about what's true. I think we can also too easily respond to our loneliness by embracing our culture's alienation. And I was thinking recently of the movie Reality Bites. I don't know how many of you guys have seen that. It's kind of a 90s flick, I guess. But I think that that film just really captures the alienation of our culture. And kind of I remember one of the really significant pieces was when one of the characters, one of the women, comments on the meaninglessness of her life, that when you're conceived during the midst of an acid trip, what do you expect life to mean? Or something along those lines. And I thought, ew, that is just really grim. And yet, I think that's the kind of alienation that we're up against in our culture. So I think too often we can embrace that and just decide we're not going to connect, we're alienated, we're, there's no point in trying to have relationships, and kind of bump around and try to get our needs met in all kinds of other ways. So too often these kind of responses, I think, don't take us toward reality, don't take us toward what's true about the world that God has created us, created and put us in. And I guess what I've been thinking about some as I've prepared for this is just kind of what loneliness, what kind of a response to loneliness could take us more toward truth and reality. It seems to me that our loneliness could very well be something true that we need to listen to. That is, that we are individuals, and that as individuals, there's a part of us that is fundamentally and at times piercingly alone, that we have to face into who we are on our own, that between me and God, who am I and who is God? And there's a fundamental, essential question that can be raised in the midst of that experience that I think we could very easily miss if we don't let ourselves know what our loneliness has to teach us. So, that said, I think that loneliness is part of the human condition. It's a part of our humanness. It is not the sole struggle of the unmarried person. It is the struggle of every person, regardless of their marital status. And as Jack has been talking about the last several times and last fall, marriage is this thing that's been created to sanctify us, not necessarily to fulfill us or to complete us, to fix everything that's wrong with us. And I think that this is inherent in that, that loneliness is part of the human condition. We have a place inside of us that is fundamentally alone, and we are individuals. And there's something okay about that. There's also something that can be really painful and frightening about that. So, but I think that it actually points us toward something that's true about who we are, who God is, what the kind of world is that we're living in, whether or not this life, this world, this place we're in is even ever meant to fill the deepest need inside of us. I think that we will have a sense of loneliness in some way in our lives until we're home, because this isn't home. It's like it's this picture of this longing. It engenders inside of us a longing for something more that is actually true, because there really is something more that we can long for and move toward and want to go for, promised in the kingdom. So letting our loneliness be true rather than covering it up by all these different avenues that I suggested earlier, I think can really be a seed in the search for more. In that sense, it raises the essential questions that we have facing us as humans. It points us toward who we are before God. It points us to our vulnerability as creatures. It's like God has me hanging by this string, and nobody else is going to catch me. And at that juncture, I'm faced with a decision. I have to decide, what am I going to do about this God? What is my response going to be to this God? And at that juncture, I have the opportunity to decide, am I going to trust him or not? And that's a really critical place to be. It's a very normal place to be. It's not that there's something wrong with me when I get there. It's that I'm being human, and that's what's true about my humanness. Does that make sense? Okay. So it's from that place of aloneness that, within ourselves, that we decide if we can trust God, if we will trust God, is He good? These are the questions that get raised. I think that's a really important process for each of us to go toward. And how we then, beyond that, deal with our feelings and our aloneness becomes, if we have touched that place inside of us and understood something about who God is and who we are, then out of that very vulnerability, we actually have the opportunity to risk and reach outside of ourselves and connect with other people. And that's where very rich and satisfying connection can happen. I would say that a deep, satisfying connection really isn't possible apart from that kind of vulnerability, because the connection otherwise is always going to be about filling that need or trying to not feel that or staying on this level of don't leave me alone, don't, you know, you have to fix me. We can be frantic in our search for ways to not go there. And we can certainly use the relationships in our lives to do that. So actually being willing to struggle with uncomfortable feelings and with our own sense of solitariness can be a place from which we actually can begin to care about people and be cared about. And that's a really good thing. So I'm going to say more about that in a minute. I'm going to say more about that right now. Something that's come up a few times along the way the last couple weeks is this idea of feeling feelings and what we do with these really big feelings that we have. It's like we want relief. We don't want to have to feel these intense feelings. We want to be fixed. We want it to go away. We want to be okay. And we want promises. And I think we've gone a long way toward trying to make Christianity make promises that fix us on that level, rather than understanding what this life is for and where God has us. And I think our feelings, I mean, this is kind of my little soapbox, as you probably already know, but I'm going to stand on it again for a minute and just say that it is very, it's sad for me when I hear people say things like, I shouldn't feel this way. Look at all the friends I have. Why do I feel lonely? Or that kind of thing. I shouldn't feel. We've learned that our feelings are somehow wrong, and I guess I just want to really challenge that assumption that our feelings are sometimes uncomfortable, and they sometimes feel really out of control, and they sometimes feel like they're going to overwhelm us. But I think that they're really good information, and if we can learn how to listen to them and interpret them, then we have a better big picture in which through which to navigate our lives and make decisions about how to care about each other, how to be cared about, and what's loving and what's not. So I can talk more about that. But for example, with loneliness, it's like if we feel lonely, then one of our first thoughts might be, there's something wrong. What's wrong with my life that I feel lonely? Well, maybe I'm feeling lonely because there's something solitary about this existence. And that's true. And that's what's true about life. Maybe I'm feeling lonely because I'm afraid to connect with other people and I keep to myself and I don't risk. Maybe I'm feeling lonely and I just need to rest in God and trust that He hears my cry and may or may not meet me there, may or may not meet the need, even though He meets me in my need. All of these things are interpretations of our feelings that we have to feel before we can interpret. So in order to understand what our feelings have to tell us, we need to learn to be with our feelings and to let our feelings be true, and let them not be necessarily right or wrong, but just they are. And what are they telling me? And what do they reflect about my experience or about my beliefs? What are they saying about me? So So our feelings are important. They're like dashboard lights. They're indicator lights on a dashboard where, you know, the oil light comes on, you know that you're supposed to pull over immediately. For those of you who don't know that, that's what your oil light means. You don't go to the next exit. You pull over right this minute. But if your low fuel light comes on and it means you still have 100 miles, then you can keep going. For me, I'd probably go another 90. You know, like to live on the edge. But it's that kind of information that our feelings can serve as. We can learn to know what it is we're responding to inside of us and decide how to respond to it. Do we need to pull over right this minute? Can we wait 90 miles? That kind of thing. And that's something that's very individual, and it's something we have to learn about ourselves as individuals in this solitary place on some level. And it's something we learn in reflecting ourselves to those people that are closest to us and having them help us see outside of ourselves. So it's not something that just happens inside of a vacuum, but it happens in the context of my relationships where I get to have things reflected back to me and I get a different perspective on me. Okay. So it seems to me that there's two extremes with loneliness that can happen, and that is that we run from it. We might want to never be alone, and we can go faster and faster so we don't have to let that feeling ever catch up with us. Or on the other extreme, we might kind of drown in it, kind of wallow, kind of decide that nobody can possibly understand where I am because nobody's ever been here before. I'm suggesting a third option that's somewhere between those two extremes, and that is that I let myself feel what I'm feeling and learn how to interpret those feelings. So it uses both my emotions and my mind. It's not one or the other. And I think that that's a big part of how God created us, that we have both of those pieces of us. So all that said, loneliness then is this place where these essential questions are raised, and that we really need to let it raise those questions for us. On the other hand, it also, I think, reflects the fact that we're created as people who are communal and who need each other and who want to be connected with each other. And certainly the view of marriage that you've been hearing the last few months is consistent with this, that marriage addresses a really deep need that God has given us, and he created marriage to address that need. A very fundamental need that he created us with, and it can be a deeply satisfying relationship, and it's not going to fix what's wrong with us. So on the one hand, it's a very satisfying relationship. On the other hand, it's not going to fulfill me and solve all my problems. It's going to be a context in which I learn who I am and who God is and how to love and be loved. So we're both... And then there's outside of marriage, which is what we're talking more about this term. Outside of marriage, there are a lot of different levels of connection that we can take advantage of and enjoy with one another, inside or outside of marriage. But I think it takes this kind of understanding of and a willingness to connect and be vulnerable that we're really drawn toward. We want to connect. We want to be known. We want to know other people. And I remember an experience I had quite a while ago when if you do those tests where you're either an introvert or an extrovert, you know, I'm one of those people that's like right smack dab in the middle. So I'm actually maybe like 1 point over on the introvert side. So there's part of me that can really hole up, and I need to hole up every now and then. And then there's another part of me that, you know, can be pretty social and pretty gregarious and all that. But it wears me out after a while, so I have to recharge this way. And there, for a long time in my world, I really embraced that part of me that didn't need people, didn't want to need people, stayed away from people. And I just thought that humans were just the weirdest things. And I just really loved, I was a biologist at the time, and I just really loved being in the woods with the birds and the critters rather than the people. And I remember this experience I had one time of walking on a beach by myself. It was on the Gulf Coast of Alabama. And I was reflecting on my view of that and how I was beginning to be more open to the fact that maybe people weren't so bad, and maybe there were people I could trust, and maybe I could connect with some people and like them and enjoy them even. And anyway, I was taking this solitary walk on this very deserted beach, and this huge thunderstorm came up. And for those of you who know me very well, thunderstorms on the Gulf Coast is one of the three things I miss the most about living in the Northwest. I love thunderstorms. And so I was just on this glorious walk. This huge thunder boomer came up. It was a little bit scary because, you know, I was on a beach, and I was the tallest thing around. So I was kind of aware of that. So I started walking back toward where my friends were, and I just saw this view on this beach of where I was, where nobody was, and where down there were all these people. And I just kind of had this thought of, look at all those humans. They just love to hang out together. And it's like I could embrace that part of me that wanted to be with them rather than over here right now. And I felt like, in a way, like an ant, if you will. But it's like ants are colonial, you know. They work together, they live together, they hang out together. And we're like that, I think. There's something about our humanness. I mean, we live in clumps. We like to hang out together. We have families. We do that. And so, anyway, all that is to say that I think that there's something really right about learning to connect with each other and embrace the part of us that wants to be connected with others. So, friendship is a great way to do that for those of us who are not married. And friendship that comes from a place of vulnerability and openness can be a very rich and rewarding experience. So it's a very complicated question on the one hand to say, how do we deal with our loneliness? Because how we deal with our loneliness is ultimately going to be a very individual process, because we are individuals. And that's what our loneliness reminds us of. So on the one hand, we're alone, and life is really hard. And on the other hand, because I know that about me, I can know that about you, and we can walk together in that. And there's a richly rewarding sense of connection that can come through that, as well as, I will suggest, healing and recovery from our fears and the things that we've learned about things that are or aren't safe, that actually connecting can be a tremendous source of healing and regeneration, if you will. So, in conclusion, inside or outside of marriage, we have needs that go unmet. God has actually given us needs that He doesn't intend to meet, for the purpose of raising essential questions about what it means to be human and what it means to trust the God who is there. And these lonely places serve to take us toward what is true and where we must ultimately trust God, and then to take us toward risking and reaching out and connecting with others. So, that's my spiel. Just have you guys make any comments that you want and add to that, or...
Nancy wanted us up here so she wouldn't be lonely.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
I just make a couple of comments. I really agree with what Nancy's saying in terms of having a strong sense at times in your life, having a really strong sense of being alone, or maybe even being for some set of circumstances, being deprived of normal relationships in a family or in friends, and getting to the place where that's a serious problem. And I think that can be a complicated problem to address. But there's a backdrop to loneliness, I think, that today is pretty pervasive. It seems to me that there's a word that is used often in describing modernists or modern culture, 20th century culture, the condition of what they call alienation, that there is today out there in the world, and has been for the century, a growing sense of confusion and despair and a kind of low-grade, common despair that comes from a deep sense of being alone in the universe. That is, the way the world is looked at today by society, in a secular society that has become sort of a taken-for-granted way of looking at who we are, has led to a deep confusion and a deep uncertainty about what it means to be human. So that loneliness is a part of the human condition, I think, in our time, that has been, it's been exacerbated, it's been made worse by the condition of how the contemporary mind, if you will, the contemporary way we look at what it means to be human. There aren't any answers. There's no model of what it means to be human. There are only sort of shots in the dark at what that looks like. And that serves to feed the sense of loneliness, and I think a twin to that is a sense of, in the sense of alienation, is a sense of meaninglessness. That life and existence has no purpose. It's purposelessness, and I don't watch a lot of television, but whenever I surf across the channels and run across a lot of the films that are out there today, and a lot of the sort of teenage, youth, 20-something subject matters that come across in music, film, and popular culture, a lot of that is based in this sense of alienation and the old existentialist term angst of not knowing who we are, what we are. And so that makes things worse, along with, I think, some of the things Nancy was saying.
Yes, and definitely, I think, the death of God in our culture has so exacerbated that, because we have this experience of being alone. What I'm seeing is that's where we find God. We find out who He is because He's actually there. Get rid of that picture and despair.
I've been married for 35 years, and it's possible, and know that from experience, it's possible to be lonely in marriage. So I think that's what Nancy's talking about when she says, it doesn't matter what your condition is, whether you're married or not married, it's a part of the human condition, a part of the situation in the world that we live in right now, and the kind of world that is, from a biblical perspective, yet unfinished. I mean, we're in a stage that we're in, and those of us who are looking to God for that, for His promises, are waiting for another stage where that fulfillment, that real fulfillment, would happen. But loneliness is, as she's already said, is a part of what's going on right now. So it's a real battle. But we do have, I mean, if we pay careful attention to the biblical picture of what it means to be a human creature, we really do find both things of what Nancy was talking about. The place and the time and the priority and the necessity of individual, independent choice making that nobody can make for you. And then as well, the fact that we need each other in the body of Christ, and we're there for each other, and we share in common a view of the world and what's going on and being human, that if we pay attention to it and listen to it and try to embrace it, we can have some incredible friendships and support and advantage in this experience of this world. How about questions from you guys now?
I'm wondering if we shouldn't read a, when you discuss the difference between alone and lonely, there's a huge difference, right? Because in a sense, we're all alone, and in heaven, we'll still be individuals and capable of being alone. But I'm assuming that in the new world, we won't be lonely. So Is it what we experience here in loneliness something we should call incomplete? Because the difference between loneliness and alone is that when you're lonely, you feel cut off. You feel like you don't belong or that you're not wanted. But you can feel that in a room full of friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
So could you discuss the implications of redefining loneliness as manifestations of incomplete?
I'm not sure I follow the incomplete part. I mean, I hear what you're saying, that it reflects something that's lacking. I mean, that's what we're saying about, like, the fulfillment part, that mm-hmm. that this life isn't going to fix everything about us. It's not going to fill us up. There's going to be a lack. So there's going to be an incompleteness in that sense. Is that what you mean?
I think so. I mean, I can imagine in, you know, the new heavens and the new earth, a person goes for a walk by themselves. A person sits down next to a pond by themselves. A person goes and spends a night in the woods by themselves. And they don't feel rebellious, and they don't feel, what's that other word for hermit? It's a real fancy, cool word.
Anthropocentric.
Pardon me?
Anthropocentric?
A man-hater. It's what it means.
Oh.
Misanthropic, that's the word. You don't feel misanthropic.
50-cent word.
You don't feel lost. You don't feel cut off. And you don't feel unwanted. But at the same time, you're alone. Mm-hmm. And you're you could be geographically isolated. Mm-hmm. And you could be out of earshot of any other human being. But you wouldn't be there to avoid human beings, and you wouldn't be there because you feel like you're avoided by human beings. And it seems to me the difference is that in the new life, being complete carries with it that sense of knowing where you belong, your niche, your eternal niche.
Mm-hmm.
You finally, the lock that you've been designed to be the key for, you're finally been put in and turned. You're there. You'll never doubt that you are wanted. You'll never doubt that you belong. You'll never doubt you have a home. And so it's not essentially aloneness that produces loneliness. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's not being an individual, having gone through
right.
Eastern religion
right.
classes. It's not.
Right.
The lie there is that thou art. You know, they try to convince you that you're part of this big one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can just cut through the illusion of individuality,
mm-hmm.
all your pain will cease. And I just think, what a horrible lie. Because it's our individuality that makes us able to love and be loved, rather than mm-hmm. loving ourselves, serving mm-hmm. ourselves, etc. On a greater scale. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good point. I think that's a really good point. I think that was kind of what I had in mind, and Nancy as well, when we talked about the the condition of this world that we're in right now as compared to the one that's coming. I think that's well put.
Okay, I have one question for Wes, and then one or maybe two for Nancy. Wes, you were talking about alienation and how that's really added to the loneliness felt in the last 100 years. Does that include for Christians? Like, because we don't believe that there is no God, is that something that we get from our culture that adds to it, or does that not have an effect?
Well, speaking for myself, I have felt, I think, the effects of that, of being in that kind of atmosphere. I think that it has some sort of effect on our outlook. I think it can have a real and it kind of depends on how we respond to that. If we know it, or if we kind of, for whatever reason, let go and sort of let ourselves absorb and, you know, sort of immerse ourselves in it. I mean, I've met young men and women in the arts, in particular, I think, who sort of in that atmosphere of being around the arts all the time and being in that sort of, often that's a very sort of dark world, and they just sort of succumb to they feel the pressure, they feel the weight, they feel the, but I think that when we believe, We are embracing a vision of ourselves, of God, of the world that He made, and of the promises of God for the future. It's an entire vision of life. To the degree that we maturely, in a mature way, embrace that, and it's become a part of our taken for granted world, that the ambiance of the atmosphere around us, I think, is lessened. But to the degree that we're immature and that we are more at the mercy of the winds of ideas and things around us, and we don't have a more mature picture of the gospel's vision of life, then I think it can have an effect on us, yeah.
And then, okay, Nancy, your turn. Sorry, you've got a couple here. You said at one point that God meets us in our need, in our loneliness, but then you also mentioned that Christianity takes the wrong perspective of, like, Christian mysticism, where God will fulfill your every need, and making all sorts of promises that God has never made. So where's the balance between God meeting us in our need and God giving us needs that He isn't going to fulfill?
Good question. I think the difference is in who's in charge of it. The perspective that I'm bringing says that it's up to God whether or not He meets me there. Sometimes He's going to leave me there because that's where He wants me to be. The Christian mystical view that's out there, I think, tends to say He would never want you to feel that. He would never make that happen for you. It's your problem that you aren't connecting with Him, or you're not in fellowship, or you're not in tune, or however they might look at that. But it's kind of, for me, it's always been in this sense of God, it can't be God's problem because God's perfect and He would never want you to be there. So it must be my fault that I'm not feeling that. What I'm saying is that it's up to God. And sometimes when it feels like God is vacationing on the other side of the universe, it's because maybe He is. And He wants me to be there for a reason, to grapple with what's true and what's real. And He is there. He's really not on the other side of the universe. I mean, so that's the part I'm saying, and He meets us there. He leaves us there as long as He desires, and we're at His mercy, and He is merciful. So He doesn't abandon us.
But we don't necessarily feel that He is still there with us. We just know it, and we have to accept that we know it.
Right. And I think we discover it there on a very deep level. And it's a level that I don't know that I can explain or describe. It's kind of that level that we talked about a few weeks ago when Christine was here. She shared about how she found out she loved God in the midst of having cancer. Margaret talked about her experience of understanding when she heard the song come up from the street that God was there in some way. I just think he comes to us in such different ways, and that's also very individual. And it's it might not be the way I think it's going to be or the way I want it to be. And there's this mystery that He meets us in our suffering, and that He uses suffering to show us that He is good. I mean, cognitively, that makes no sense. And yet, I know that because I got it there. And I don't know how else to describe it. Is that helpful?
Okay. Yeah,
that was just the first one.
That's very helpful. Yeah, that was only the first one. Okay. The second one goes back earlier, and you were talking about us either running away from our loneliness or wallowing in it, and that they're both extremes, and we should find a middle ground. And there are two parts. This is still just one question, but there are two parts to it. The first is, how do you find whether you're wallowing or running, and then how do you find the middle ground once you know which side you're on?
Well, I think we both do both. I mean, we all do both. You know, I both do both. I think we can do either one. And I guess the answer to both of those parts of it is we find out by letting ourselves feel, by letting ourselves know what we're feeling, and deciphering it and navigating it. So I might fall off on this side and then figure out, okay, that's what that feels like. I might fall off on this side and that's what that feels like. So I'm just going to kind of find my way. But I think what it takes is being willing to be uncomfortable. Because both of these, I think, take us away from having to feel the uncomfortable. This one might take me toward being depressed. Depressed can often be a numb feeling, a not feeling feeling. Going over here can be anxious, out here, but away from the uncomfortable. So both of those directions take us away from actually being uncomfortable. So being willing to go through the feelings of being uncomfortable, feeling lonely, feeling afraid, feeling sad, those negative feelings, I think can be instructive that way.
And that's not wallowing in it?
Right. Right. Wallowing, I think, comes when I'm using it to not act or I'm not willing to be... It's a different feel. It's... how can I describe it?
Wallowing, for me, would be not wanting to understand, not coming back. And it involves the process of feeling that and then trying to understand it and then... understand it in accordance with what I think is true. Okay, so God loves me and I need to love God and I need to love others. How is that consistent with truth? What I'm feeling about being lonely and using my mind, my logic to understand my feelings and come back to that. And I think that both those things also alienate us towards anxiety. I just think of very busy people. Not that I would ever be one of them. Or towards depression, just turning inward. And I think that taking the time to feel your feelings and process them with your, you know, with all of you, not just wallowing in them, that's a process that can engage others. Not to ask them to fix it for you, but to say, this is going on with me. You're like me. You're human. You're alone.
Yeah.
Help me process this. And engaging them and helping you process rather than saying, I'm wallowing. Can you wallow with me? Because wallowing is a very dramatic thing to do, and let's all wallow. You know, that's kind of cheeky, but does that make sense?
I really connected with what you were talking about, your belief long ago that truly superior individuals didn't need people, because I think I came up that way. I'm not altogether sure how I came by that belief. But it wasn't because of a religious background or anything. But I think the people that I admired the most seemed not to need people. And so I had sort of gotten the impression that truly superior people didn't need anybody.
It was cooler.
I'm sorry?
It was cooler.
They're definitely cooler. And especially I grew up at a time sort of like the heyday of encounter groups and...
Yeah.
When everybody I knew was a psychology major and everything, and one of the things that people were always talking about was somebody was a needy individual. Oh, that was definitely an inferior kind of individual, to be a needy individual. And so when I became a Christian, and already being possessed of this perspective that truly superior individuals didn't need anybody, and so I folded that in with Christianity, and the truly spiritual person doesn't need anybody. But it always bothered me that after God created Adam, you know, I was thinking, who else would you want to hang out with if you could hang with God? I mean, that would be perfect, right? So God's walking around the garden and Adam's there. Why would you need anybody else, right? But Adam, after... Clearly, he wasn't there all the time, and God deliberately did that because he says to God, there's nobody here like me. Well, heck, God's like you. I mean, you're in his image, right? Well, nobody here on a regular basis, I guess. It's possible to be hanging with God a certain amount of time, literally experiencing God, and to be lonely. So it made me think, that doesn't quite work with my idea that truly superior individuals don't need anybody. And then, talk about your truly superior individual. Jesus says, the birds of the air have their nests and the foxes have their dens, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. I mean, that's a very wistful, lonely kind of thing to say. And if Jesus could be lonely, then maybe truly superior individuals do, in some sense, need each other. When God said it's not good for man to be alone, he didn't seem to be saying it's not good for inferior men to be alone, but it's perfectly okay for superior people to be alone, because that's the way they are. I mean, we were created that way. So I think I had to move past that idea, which was essentially hypocritical anyway, because I decided that since I was a superior individual, then therefore I must not need people. Well, both of those things was a load of crap. So, but I had to come to the place where I realized, no, it's okay to need people. God made me that way. Being superior shouldn't get in the way of my needing people. So I really appreciate it with what you said.
I was wondering if you could comment on this problem that exists within marriage. It is, you know, if there's any relationship, you need to be open and vulnerable in as a marriage relationship. However, if a big problem in marriage, one that's very seldom addressed before it's entered into, is that we, for very many reasons, are lonely, are alien to begin with, and then I can think of a dozen other reasons. If that's not dealt with, it's quite possible to enter into marriage and just crush the life out of the other person. So I was wondering if you could comment on what's just looking at the two opposites. Is there any principles that you could give to know when you're doing one and not doing the other, and how to get to the place if you're deficient on either side?
Well, I think that you're right. In marriage, just as much as outside of marriage, we have to learn to be responsible with our feelings, and we have to learn that ultimately our feelings are ours and they're not the responsibility of the other person. And that's a lifelong process for us. And I think actually marriage is a really good environment to figure that out in an open marriage where you can reflect to each other what's going on. And I think the way you navigate that is by committing to being a certain kind of person in the midst of this marriage, and learning to communicate about it, to talk about it. How do you experience me right now? How do I experience? How might I be experienced right now? Am I overwhelming you because I'm so full of need right now? Help me be responsible with that. Is that kind of what you're talking about? How do we not overwhelm each other, kind of, or abandon each other, not need at all, or
there,
or those the two extremes?
Oh, there's a lot of ways that you can crush one another just by saying that you need to make me happy, you need to meet all my needs. There's a problem, with relationships with the opposite sex. There's something that, I had a female friend that was very, very wiggy, as I call it, very, had some ideas about the Bible that I was really, really interested in. And there was kind of a tension there, especially since I was,
you know, open about, hey, you know, this is the relationship, you know, with my wife. And this is, you know, why I like to talk about it. And we didn't really talk about doctrine because about, you know, far out biblical things, you know, being, exploring ideas, because my wife just wasn't into that. And I was really called down for, you know, keeping this relationship. And so you run into things like that where no one person is going to meet your needs. And, you know, if one person has a need, well, you need to make me happy, you know, and that makes a person very insecure, too.
It's a big responsibility.
Yeah, it's
too much for anyone.
So, yeah, I was just asking for, you know, if you ever thought about this problem, that you need to be vulnerable and you need to meet your needs, and you need not to crush the other, you need not to take. And then you have this problem with the fear of other relationships. And it's just really a big mess. I think, you know, you're touching on one of the biggest messes.
Absolutely.
Anything you have to say on that?
I think you're right. These lives of ours have mess written all over them. Big letters. But yeah, I think we've been talking a bit about taking responsibility for our feelings, and I think that's part of what you're talking about is learning to navigate by knowing who I am and what I need and not thinking that marriage is what's going to fix me, and being willing to work with and commit to loving this other person, then part of my navigating is going to be deciding what is loving and how do I make them the most important person in my world. How do I not crush them? And where do I go to get needs met that they aren't able to meet or face into not getting those needs met and be okay with that? Grieve that, mourn that, work with it.
Thank you for your latest spiel in the news and views.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I think you guys have touched on this a couple times, but I need you to kind of explain some to me. Like, I've heard often and honestly believed that we could find complete satisfaction and fulfillment in God on this earth through the work of Christ. And I've heard you say now that that's not possible. And so I was wondering, like, why you feel that way, why you believe that. That's
good question. Yeah, it's a good question. Wes, take it away.
Well, I was taught early on as a Christian that from a perspective that was reading certain passages, certain verses, certain texts in the Bible in a way that was more or less ripping them out of context and patching together a picture of Christianity that saw it as a very victorious, triumphalist kind of human existence in this world. And as I've looked at the Bible, listened to people that I trust teach the Bible accurately over the years, just slowly but surely that picture is just basically dissolved in terms of having a real biblical basis. If you read the Bible and understand the Bible correctly, the Bible does not present a this worldly experience for the believer that is guaranteeing some sort of victory and triumph in the kinds of terms that we often think about that, about just generally mostly always being happy, not having bad things happen to you, when you need something God supplies it all the time, and if you just do the right stuff, read the Bible enough, pray enough, engage yourself in the right kinds of activities and projects, that in general you can pull yourself together, and God's done all he's gonna do for you, and it's all been laid up, and all you have to do is access it now with the right the right turn of the switches. And I just don't think the Bible teaches that. So I think the answer to your question is actually it's a big answer that would come from a lot of places throughout the scriptures. But what comes to mind immediately is those places where verses, as I said, especially in the epistles and the gospels, that are more or less ripped out of context and put into a frame in which they appear to be saying, you should be having a victorious Christian life kind of experience. Now, the way you framed the way you stated the question, I think I'm missing something. You said something about, how did you put the question? Feels like maybe I haven't quite addressed.
Well, I think you have addressed it. I mean, what you said, that it would take a long list of scriptures and stuff, I figured that would be true. But I wanted to make sure that I understood what you guys were saying, too, that we can't be fulfilled here on this earth. So, I mean, is that, I'm sorry if I'm interrupting somebody up there, is that because of sin, or is that because
sin, but it seems to me, I'm talking about this a little bit at church on Sunday right now, on Ecclesiastes, it just seems to me that book is one of the most explicit places where the issue of the beauty, the awesome beauty and power of this world, and the picture of all that is true enough, but the actual experience of the world, when you insert the human creature into the picture, and your own experience and observations of other humans' experiences of the world, you really see how this world has a sort of uncanny futility built into it, that there's just something missing, something pervasively missing. And it oftentimes is very subtle, maybe even most of the time is very subtle. It's only when men and women become reflective, when they start step back and really look at their experience and see and sense that something hauntingly is missing. That try as they may in all these areas, relationships, making money, building things, I mean, all the things that the author of Ecclesiastes did, which was a phenomenal catalog of things. When he stepped back and looked at it all, he had this pervasive sense of, as beautiful it is, as amazing as it is, it all seems to be hung on this problem of nothing really gets any better. This is as good as it gets, and that's just not enough. So there's something, as I said, hauntingly missing from everything that we... There are times, I mean, we can have good times, and he talks about that in the book. There are lots of enjoyments in this world, but there's something in the end about everything that it just starts to... To use his language, it feels more like a vapor than something that's really substantive, that's something that's really solid. We just don't feel the weight, as C.S. Lewis, the weight of glory yet. We feel something severely less than that at this point.
And I just to kind of add to that a little bit, I think we've heard Ecclesiastes interpreted a lot in the sense of before we know Christ, before we know the Lord, that's our experience. I think a more honest read of Ecclesiastes doesn't really show that. I mean, this is Solomon talking, and he was really wise, and I think it points more clearly to, like Wes is saying, something that's truly missing here, and something that this world isn't even meant to bring, because it isn't the kingdom, and that it's built in a way to set up the longing for that for us.
Can you still, Nancy, rebut the "but Solomon didn't have Jesus" response to what you just said?
The what?
But Solomon didn't have Jesus. He had everything else, and he was a chosen. You know, he had everything probably within his
right.
What was spiritually available to him at his grasp, but.
But he didn't have the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, evangelical Christendom would still say he was lacking. And would use that as a a jumping off point for a whole lot of theology.
Having spent quite a bit of time in evangelical Christendom, I mean, there's a lot of good people I've met there and good things, but what I was going to say, Eric, when you asked that was, biblically speaking, it doesn't make sense to me that that would be the picture, that we can find that now. And my experience tells me that I can't find that now, because either I'm just more evil than everybody else and I can't quite get there, but then I look around and I go, gosh, nobody really seems to have figured it out either. And I don't know. I don't see it a lot in that culture where even people that say they have it figured out, then why are they unkind? Why are they still, you know, at the heat of the moment, you know, we're all working to do the best we can, and I believe, you know, that's great. But at the heat of the moment, there's still unkindness. And so if we had it figured out, if we were arrived, then why are we still so unkind to each other? And I don't know. That's just experience. And why do we still suffer if we've arrived? It doesn't make sense to me.
Kind of on the same note, what I always guess is Paul's comments about longing for the end. And it seems like that's exactly what you guys are talking about, that there's on the one hand the sort of loneliness and sense of incompletion and unfulfillment that is stemming directly from my own sin and that I need to look into and deal with, because it's an inappropriate sort of sense of wanting or a sense of incompletion or dissatisfaction. But then to get to that sense of incompletion and longing that is totally apart from my own sin, that comes from, you know, that intense and sincere conviction that know what I'm really made for and what's really going to be meaningful is being done with my sin and being able to rest in the kingdom finally.
Not only does Paul say that that creation has been subjected to futility in hope of something coming, in hope that is seen as not hope, for why does one hope for what one sees, that seems to suggest that whatever is coming, it's coming, it's not available to us now. But look at Jesus himself. I mean, if anybody had Jesus, Jesus had Jesus. And his life was not a cakewalk. There's no indication that he went through and said, hallelujah, they're going to put, thorns in my head and they're going to stick spikes through my hands and my feet and they're going to beat me and they're going to spit on me. There's no indication that when people did spit on him that he just went, oh, no big deal. When he wept over Jerusalem and said, you know, how often I wanted to gather you like a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. I mean, that's grief there. So if Jesus, the most perfect human being who ever lived, he's perfect. If Jesus was not running around, you know, all blissed out all the time, how in the world could we ever expect to be it? So it's not just our own sin that does it. If we were without sin, we would still grieve. We would still be lonely. We would still be capable of being hurt and disappointed. It says Jesus didn't trust men because he knew their hearts. I mean, what kind of an isolation is that, not to be able to trust another human being because you, above more than anybody else, know what's in the hearts of men. It seems like being perfect would only make things worse because you would see things more clearly. At least we have the illusion. We're in denial about, oh, maybe someday if I get a raise, if I get that stereo system, if I get that Ferrari, if I get that guy, if I get that house, if I, you know, whatever it is, we've got this illusion that happiness is on the horizon. Jesus had no such illusions to comfort him. It's true. He did have, knowing that this was going someplace and that his good father was in charge of all this and doing all this stuff, but his life was hell. So I think that above anything convinces me that Solomon's problem was not merely that he didn't have Jesus, because Jesus had Jesus, and he didn't have a happy life.
And then there's Mr. Peter. Since Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves for the same purpose. And I think marriage and Christian marriages are so bad, they don't deal with their loneliness.
Is there anything unique to the post-Christ advent of history for the believer? I'm thinking of what Paul describes in his illustration of the body and the parts. None can do anything without the other. Going back to what Nancy said sort of at the beginning about her, the beach scene, that's what I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a unique role in your life because you're a believer and you were almost, you feel, is there a responsibility for you in being a believer that you need to, there's a certain role for you in the fellowship of Christendom? Is that unique to the believer's experience at the very least?
If what you're getting at is, since we do know the gospel, we do have it explained, we are in history at a point where we can see what God was doing, the fulfillment of his promise in Christ. And now we own that, we possess that. And because of that, and the indications of Scripture where we, in the New Testament talks about gifts, talks about us being gifted with the opportunities. God actually not only saves us, but he gives us the blessings of opportunities to be involved in each other's lives. And it seems to me, interestingly enough, again, I'll hearken back to what I was looking at in Ecclesiastes, that essentially that's what Solomon says is about the only thing worth this in this existence. The one enjoyment he has is what he talks about in terms of having a good meal with your friends and having a good glass of wine or enjoying each other. I mean, that he says that's as good as it gets. I mean, there's a very real resonance with that. And the sense that I've experienced, and I'm sure a lot of people have, if not everybody, the sense of the little bit of solid that we do feel in a world that's filled with vapors, and much of it is our own vapor, is that connection that we have with each other as we understand the gospel together. That solid sense that we have of this is real. This is what makes everything real. That's not nothing. That's the joy, I think, that the New Testament talks about.
Amen. I think that's a good place to stop. We're out of time, aren't we?